Hi, I'm Andrea Ruggeri, and this is the Piece of Advice podcast, coming to you from the University of Oxford. Today, we are sitting down with Professor Lise Howard from Georgetown University to talk about United Nations peace operation and their effectiveness. Thank you, Lise, for coming.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
So these are terrific and exciting, but also dramatic times for studying international politics and also United Nations. Several commentators and several analysts are saying that the United Nations is powerless. But in your work, you have written that United Nations operations have different forms of power, and they can be actually successful with these different forms of power. So can you tell us a bit more about this and help us to actually tackle this possible tension, a United Nations powerless and a United Nations and UN operation with different form of successful powers?
Great. That's a great opening question. Thank you so much, Andrea. So there is a question, and certainly we're hearing it a lot today, given Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that about whether the UN is powerless. And in my view, it's kind of the wrong question, because we choose whether the UN is powerful or powerless. And the fact of the matter is, the nature of threats, of the threats that we face across the world today, whether it's climate change or pandemic disease or armed conflict or nuclear weapons, no state and no region is going to be able to tackle these threats on its own. It's simply none of the problems we can't even begin to think about resolving them as individual states. And the United Nations is the only truly global international organization. And so from my point of view, it's almost an existential need to figure out how to enable the UN to function better, because we all need the UN to function better. It's just a fact of the world we live in today. So specifically, you asked about peacekeeping. I can talk about peacekeeping unless you wanted to ask something else right now.
No, this is terrific. And so the necessity also to pool resources and coordinate and trying also to move the conflict from the battleground to a diplomatic table is crucial. But also in a recent review that you have done with Barbara Walter and Paige Forna, you also stressed that actually, usually peace operations are successful. So the United Nations, it can seem sometimes powerless, but when the United Nations deploy blue helmets, they are effective in stopping the conflict and also saving civilians' lives.
Yes, and it's surprising. We did not know when we set out to write that review. It's about 150 works in the last few years about peacekeeping. We did not expect to find so many such convincing, overwhelming positive results, especially in the quantitative literature as it looks to peacekeeping. So the primary goal of peacekeepers now is civilian protection. And we have more than a dozen studies that demonstrate that peacekeepers protect civilian lives. All else equal, they're sent to the hardest places. Peacekeepers are protecting civilian lives. Without UN peacekeeping, many more people would be dying. We also find across the literature, so we have multiple peer-reviewed studies using different data sets. These are different research teams with different funding streams. Everyone's just trying to find, you know, robust results, and multiple times researchers have found robust results that peacekeepers help to end civil wars more quickly than they would have ended otherwise. Civil wars don't endure as long, so they're shorter, they recur less often. It's more likely that we'll have a peace agreement where peacekeepers are promised during a negotiation process. We also have a difficult topic when it comes to sexual exploitation and abuse. I think everybody knows that peacekeeping has had an issue with abuse. And we also have two recent studies that demonstrate, and some of your work also, Andrea, of course, your work about civilian protection, that when we have more UN peacekeepers, we have less sexual and gender-based violence in the midst of civil war. So it's a mixed bag. It's not as if peacekeepers are the perfect solution. We see increased trafficking, for example, but they come with remarkable results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and actually we also will cover unintended consequences of peacekeeping. But what I would like to ask you is whether you can give us an idea about when you talk about power in peacekeeping and when you actually tell us that perhaps the deterrence, muscular power, is not the most important. You suggest that actually persuasion is a crucial form of power than the blue helmets can have. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yes, happy to. Thanks. So I argue in this book that the UN, actually most entities, seek to exercise three basic forms of power. Persuasion is the first, and there are negative and positive forms of persuasion, right? So somebody might seek to convince somebody else that elections are a good way to organize, to figure out who should lead a country is through democratic elections. So it's through spreading ideas. It's also sometimes through shaming bad behavior when people exhibit bad behavior. So we have persuasion, we have inducement, how UN peacekeepers seek to change behaviors through offering things, building institutions, and then also restricting markets sometimes through sanctions. And then there's coercion. Persuasion has to do with ideational forms of power, symbolic forms, and education. Inducement and coercion are both more material. Coercion is the trickiest one when it comes to peacekeeping because it's hard to understand peacekeeping. Peacekeepers are most peacekeepers. There are always civilian contingents, but most UN peacekeepers serve in their national military forces, and then they volunteer or they are volunteered to serve with the United Nations. One would think that because they're military, that they should be able to exercise offensive force, that they should be able to go after rebels and kill them. But that is not how peacekeeping was originally envisioned. And I argue at the end of the day, that's not how peacekeeping works. That's not how they exercise power. So peacekeepers in these missions come. The diversity is actually an asset, as you, Andrea, have argued elsewhere, right? So peacekeepers come from dozens of different countries. They don't speak each other's languages. They don't train together before they deploy. They don't have standard command and control mechanisms among and between units. So I can't, for example, if I'm an Indian force commander, I can't command the Moroccan battalion to go take out a rebel group. There's no court-martialing process in peacekeeping missions. It all works by agreement among peacekeepers. And what they can do is they can defend civilians, they can defend themselves, right? So sometimes that involves military acts, but not the offensive use of force, not controlling the battlefield through their overwhelming military power. That is not how peacekeeping works, is what I'm arguing in this book.
Thank you. And I would like to actually mention another recent piece of research of yours published in International Organization, because is also about the use of force and the idea whether it's important to have a mandate in peace operation that support the use of force. And you suggest, you highlight how in the last few years the UN Security Council has been moving forward a logic of force, so providing mandates where enforcement is substantive and important. However, first, you also argue that, based also on your book, that this is maybe not the most efficient way to go. But also in that piece, you have a very important argument. What are the causes? Why this policymaker have decided that is the best solution? So can you tell us a bit more about this other thread of your research?
Sure, yes, thank you. So it's looking more specifically at decision-making in the UN Security Council. And it's very puzzling because since 1999, all complex UN peacekeeping missions have been authorized to use force, even though peacekeepers don't have the capacity to use force, and the P5 don't want UN peacekeepers to develop this capacity. So it's a genuine puzzle. Why would we be authorizing all UN peacekeeping missions, all complex, you know, multidimensional peacekeeping missions in civil wars under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter? How can we explain this funny phenomenon? And I honestly, going into this research, did not know the answer, because it's one of those puzzles that just doesn't make sense on the face of it. So I was thinking maybe we could find some kind of constructivist argument about agency. Just none of the alternative arguments that you might find in the literature about bureaucratic politics, or rational arguments about achieving means through these decision-making processes. None of those worked. So I wound up reading 100 years of small group psychology literature, because at the end of the day, the Security Council is a strong group. They are a small group. They are a strong group. They are an exclusive group. They don't want others to join. They are a legitimate group. Whenever there's an international dispute in the international system, it still goes to the Security Council. If you look at the Security Council's agenda, every dispute is still on their agenda. And so they're functioning as a small elite group, and they've come to a decision about Chapter 7 missions. And what we're arguing with my former student, Anjali Dayal, who's now a professor at Fordham University in New York, is that the Security Council's legitimacy is based on its ability to issue decisions. It's not representative. It's not an elected body. Its legitimacy stems from its ability to issue decisions. And since it's come to this decision about the mandate to use force in peacekeeping, it continues to repeat it because it's an easy, once they've come to that decision, it's easier to repeat it than try to figure out something new. That's the basic argument. But now, of course, the UN Security Council is in doubt in a way that when we wrote this piece, we never could have envisioned. For most of the past 22 years, Vladimir Putin has been a calculating and rational actor in international relations. And this war in Ukraine is neither of those. I mean, and so we don't know whether the Security Council is going to continue to function with Russia becoming a pariah. Yes.
Right. No, and this is, you know, this is actually something that I wanted to ask you. But first, I wanted to say that actually, Anjali Dayal, she will be one of our next guests with her new book. So it's fantastic you mentioned her and her fantastic work. So I know that you have also background in Russian language, so you have been able to follow closely also in different language and perhaps rhetoric the ongoing debate in the UN. So I know that maybe we are entering the speculation about international politics, but clearly it's important to know what do you think has been Russia's role in the UN so far in the UN Security Council, and how the system has been reacting to, clearly, as you have highlighted, a very unexpected Russian behavior and Russian use and rhetoric and also description of the events in Ukraine. Mm. So can you tell us something more?
Can I tell you more? I know there are so many sources right now. So Russia and China, for a very long time, have been voting with the P3. And sometimes we say they're voting, you know, they're going along to get along. Right. So since 1999, Russia and China have, well, on and off, but very rarely they use the veto power. Most of the time, if something rises to the top of the P3 agenda, the P3, of course, being the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, who are the pen holders for peacekeeping missions, if something rises to the top of those agendas, Russia and China have generally been agreeing. Sometimes they dissent, but usually they agree to get along. Russia, on February 24th, violated all of the basic principles of the UN Charter, right? The UN Charter declares the inviolability of sovereign borders. Russia, for all of this time, has been upholding the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity. They are the member of the UN Security Council that is continuously bringing up the issues of sovereignty and territorial integrity and how the actions of other states might be violating those bedrock principles of international relations and international law. And so when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014, in Crimea and then in Donbass and Luhansk and Donetsk, parts of those two oblasts, in Ukraine, those were primarily Russian-speaking territories. There was a referendum in Crimea. Crimea had historically been a part of the Russian Empire, you know, and moved to Ukraine in the 1950s, the Russian Empire and the Soviet Empire. So there was kind of a sense, and he was very crafty about it all, right? You know, not actually sending Russian forces to those places, but sending quote unquote little green men and preparing the way with this referendum and preparing the way through cyber war and disinformation and things. So he got away with it in those instances. And the rest of the Security Council let that slide. But what has just happened a couple of weeks ago, that was something entirely different. I mean, invading your neighbor using mechanized, you know, tank battalions and standard sort of World War II invasion. We just haven't seen that between states, even though we see an increase in internationalized civil wars in the international system. We haven't seen something like this by a member of the Security Council, by a nuclear power against its neighbor. And so the Security Council is paralyzed. And so the matter went to the General Assembly. And this is where the rest of the world is pushing back against Russia. The General Assembly came to a vote, 141 members in favor of this resolution against Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and saying it very plainly and clearly, we all agreed at the end of World War II that we would not allow states to seek imperial domination over other states. This is our basic promise of the United Nations Charter. And this is a violation of the Charter. And so we have, you know, there is still a mechanism in the UN system to punish Russia, is really what it is, with international sanctions right now. And we'll see where else it goes.
Right. And clearly, we are witnessing something that it seems unique. As you said, we have noticed an increase of internationalized civil war. We know that since the 70s, actually almost 80% of civil war has third-party support in terms of finance and material, but this is really a military occupation and invasion. I'm going to move on couple of questions that talk more about the future. One is actually the fact that I know that you're starting and working on a new research agenda that actually breaks some traditional boundaries of our understanding of peace operation. So I'm very eager to know and share also with the listener what are these new questions that you are trying to answer.
Thank you. So peacekeeping missions, peace operations have at their disposal primarily the mechanisms of persuasion and coercion, right? So they have, I'm arguing that when we see peacekeeping missions, it's kind of a military, sort of a military-like endeavor. And then there's also aspects of persuasion. But what we don't see are peacekeeping missions actively trying to manage the illicit economies that fuel many of the civil wars across the Sahel and the Middle East right now. So we have these growing illicit economies that do not provide any incentive to rebels or governments, for that matter, to step back to step away from the battlefield and to engage more in politics because they're able to continue profiting off of the illicit networks. And so we have the United Nations peace operations that don't really touch on illicit networks. And we also have actions by the World Bank and the IMF and other development agencies that also ignore illicit markets. No one right now has a mandate to try to tackle illicit markets. And we think of Afghanistan, right? How was the Taliban able to rise to power so quickly and to fund itself? So it's, you know, the United States has been ignoring this issue for many years in a variety of different places. So, and it's not just the United States, it's the entire, it's all international organizations. And so this project is looking at the role of illicit networks and trying to figure out when we have instances of the past, such as the Kimberley process that helped to conclude the wars in Sierra Leone and Liberia, what were the circumstances under which circling in on illicit networks proved successful? And the question is whether one might be able to replicate that or devise policies around those ideas of stemming illicit networks, which could have multiple types of benefits, not only by concluding civil wars, but also by helping to rebuild economies.
This is fantastic. I mean, clearly it brings together a lot of research agenda that so far have been not really connected. And as you said, it's also not just freezing the conflict, but also the post-conflict strategy of the United Nations. I'm going to ask you something more about your institutional role in ACUNS. And you've been actually serving in a very important role in this institution. And I'm wondering whether you can tell us a bit more about ACUNS, but also how students of scholars of peace and policymakers can benefit from its activities.
Oh, great. Yeah, thank you. I was elected president of ACUNS a couple of years ago, and I have a couple years on my clock still. ACUNS was founded in the 1980s. It was actually during the Cold War at Dartmouth College, which is an Ivy League university here in the U.S. And it was a bunch of concerned scholars came together to think about serious scholarship about the United Nations. That was the idea. We need to have some kind of scholarly organization that devotes its attention to serious scholarly questions and research about the United Nations system broadly, the UN system broadly, and multilateralism in general. And so they founded this scholarly organization. It was at Brown. It was hosted at Dartmouth and then Brown and then at Yale and then in Canada and the United Kingdom. And so the network has broadened over time. It is truly an international network now with about 5,000 scholars on the email list around the world interested in the serious study of the United Nations. We also have increasing connections to the policy world and to policymaking in the policymakers and policy shapers in and around the UN system. So the annual meeting in June of this year, this association meets every June around UN Charter Day, the signing of the UN Charter, which is June 26th. That also happens to be my birthday. So it's always a party or a funny kind of a party. So this year it'll be at the annual meeting will be at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, co-hosted by the Graduate Institute and also UN Geneva. So we'll have some of our opening events at UN Geneva. Tatiana Valovaya is of course the Director General of UN Geneva as a Russian national. And my hope, we'll see, is that we can have some serious conversations about where the UN system might go now with this invasion of Russia. Maybe by then the invasion will be over. Maybe by then we'll be able to start to have a conversation about what happens next in the UN system. But given the events, it's a little bit difficult to predict. But so at this annual meeting, we're introducing not only scholarly research, but also this idea of how to translate scholarly research so that it's more digestible for a policy audience. This is part of our mission, is to create, you know, apps and tools and ways of thinking about translating policy research, scholarly research, so that we're not just reaching a scholarly audience, which has been maybe part of one of the main changes we want to bring to this association. Yeah.
Right. And actually, this is really it links really well to my last question, because one of our goals of this podcast is to share research knowledge also with practitioners, policymakers, and analysts. And, you know, and the big question is, so if you could provide some major policy suggestion in order to make peace operation more successful, and we know that United Nations with A4P and different review has been thinking about major changes, but in a nutshell, what do you think would be, in terms of impact, the major change the UN should be doing in order to improve peace operation success?
The first thing is that the Security Council, all diplomats need to bring peacekeeping back into the conversation. There has not the UN has not authorized a new peacekeeping mission since 2014. It's been 8 years since peacekeeping has been on the table. And of course, it started with the Trump administration, but we're no longer in the Trump administration. It's peacekeeping is not a part of the dialogue anymore. And that is a problem. We know that peacekeeping works. We know that peacekeeping has been successful in a lot of different contexts. It's especially successful when peacekeepers adapt to the context. In none of the current civil wars that I know of are peacekeepers even part of the discussion or the negotiations, whereas that was a standard part of the negotiation processes for concluding civil wars before, is holding out the promise of peacekeepers to help conclude, to move from violence to politics, to nonviolent politics. So I know that A4P is interesting. There are important and technical advances in A4P. But the fact of the matter is, none of that really matters if the UN isn't really doing peacekeeping anymore. So part of what I think scholars can contribute to this conversation is to remind policymakers that peacekeeping is actually an effective tool, and that it would be a shame for the UN to give up on this tool because it is promising. So that's the first point. The second is that I think we want policymakers to be informed. We need to create more fora where policymakers can tell researchers what they want to know about the world. So in other words, we have a lot of scholarship that is being creative in absence of dialogue with policymakers, right? So we're sort of in a conversation with ourselves. We need to broaden the conversation to policymakers, but we also need to hear from policymakers about what they want to know. I think that that would be a promising way forward in this dialogue. So scholars asking policymakers directly what they would like us to, what types of research they would like us to engage in.
Thanks, Liz. And I think this is also, it really highlight part of the philosophy of this podcast series of the hub of collaboration with the United Nations Academic Impact at Oxford. And I completely agree with you. We have to move from a monologue to a dialogue where we can tell and speak with policymakers, but also we really want to know what they need to know. So, Liz, I'm going to thank you for your time and participation in our podcast, The Peace of Advice. Thanks for coming and stay safe. And I hope to see you in person soon.
Thank you, Andrea. It was a pleasure.